Okay, we're just about to start the class. Good to see everybody today. If you can hear the audio fine, just type in audio okay. Otherwise, we'll just refresh your browsers. Okay, so before we start, let's everybody just type in audio okay, just to make sure that you can hear the audio. So type in the words audio okay, just to confirm that everybody is hearing the audio all right. Hey, good to see your audio is okay there, Cappy and Jean. If everybody else can type in audio okay, there's a number of other people online. Sarah, Philip, Dan, Samar, Deborah in Virginia, John in New York, Rebecca in Israel. Continue today with more of a philosophy on Hanukkah. We'll be referring to the Gemara and Gemara Shabbos, as well as to the Rambam, to Maimonides, in the laws of Hanukkah, the last few laws. Questions from last time. We'll see if Nava joins us, and as well as Lou. They had a few questions last time, so we'll try to address those if they join us today. Okay, Sarah, thank you for the audio. Okay. Thank you. Africa in New York, Daryl in New York, good to see you both. Just going to wait just a moment or two more just to make sure everybody has confirmed that the audio is working. If you hear the audio, just type in audio okay, and we'll get going. And at the end, we'll have a question and answer session. Good to see you, Sandy, Toronto. Just type in audio okay. Make sure that you're picking up the audio fine. Thank you, Sandy. All right, it looks like we got a go ahead. So let's start. Okay, we're discussing different aspects of Hanukkah. One aspect that we didn't ask yet is in terms of the brachos. We understand what we say lahadlak ner shel Hanukkah, that we say the blessing before we actually light the candles, like we do with any other command, any other mitzvah. So we would light, we would say the blessing before we do the actual command. The reason for saying the blessing is, my understanding is to understand that the act we're about to do is a command. So before just going from a mundane activity and then just doing a fulfillment of a mitzvah, so by actually saying a bracha, we reiterate the idea that this is a command that we're about to do. So we actually do the action for the sake of fulfillment. Now, it's interesting that blessings themselves have different, there are different types of blessings. I'm going to do it to begin. I'm going to describe two blessings that you may not all be familiar with, and I'd like to hear your comments as to what type of blessing do you think this is. So, for example, there's a blessing that we say, "Blessed are you, God, our God, King of the world, for there are such as these in the world." We say that when we see the beautiful people, or beautiful trees, or beautiful fields. And upon seeing this beauty, so we say, "Blessed are you, God, our God, King of the world, that there are such as these to you in your world." So, what type of blessing is this? I understand when, let's say, I'm about to eat, so I say a blessing over the food, the fruit, the vegetable, the grain, the bread, the wine. That's because we're not supposed to, the Gemara says, you're not allowed to benefit from this world without saying a blessing. And if you do, it's as if you're stealing, all right? Because everything is God's creation. And you only have rights to benefit if you make a recognition, you recognize who created these. So the question is, now how does it fit in when we say a blessing over seeing a beautiful person or beautiful trees or fields? That's one question. What type of blessing is that? And then there's another blessing. Let's say we see a deformed person or an abnormal looking person or animal. So upon seeing any of these, we say the blessing, "Blessed are you, God, our God, King of the world, who distorts creation." So what type of blessing is that? So in order to get insight into the blessings, we have to understand what was the thinking behind the rabbis, Ezra, who set up all of the blessings that we have, all the prayers that we have. We have to try to understand the categories that these blessings fall into. So the question I'm posing you with now is the blessing over beautiful people, trees, and fields. What's the concept behind that blessing? And what's the blessing about when we see abnormal-looking people or animals? Okay, so that's a question. You think about it for a minute or so. And then if you'd like, type into the window what your thinking is on it. But again, what we're trying to do is categorize what type of blessing this is. So that's the question. And then we'll move on to the blessing of Sha'asa Nisim, which has to do with Hanukkah. Okay, if everybody has a question, just type in okay in the window, just so I understand that you all have the question clear. Okay, Gene, thank you. Sarah, thank you. Keep in mind that the way to approach this would be to realize that if there's a blessing on something, so this means that the rabbis wanted us to have the right outlook. For example, let's use the blessing on fruits or vegetables for an example. A person without having the blessing, he might think he's entitled to these fruits. He's entitled to just take what he wants in the world. So you see that the Gemara addresses a incorrect concept that a person might harbor. So the incorrect concept is that the person would feel that everything is, I'm entitled to everything, it's here, I'm entitled to it all. So therefore the blessing comes along, it tells the person this is not true. Not only is it not true, but taking something without a blessing would be considered stealing. So the rabbis had to clarify the state of mind and the right outlook we should have in terms of our own personal benefit in the world. So benefit is something which is not just a natural entitlement just because I'm here. That's something which you have to recognize that it's granted to you, but it's on a condition that there's a recognition that you know where it's coming from. So a blessing is something which comes to correct a person's outlook. Now, keeping that in mind, what would be the incorrect disposition, the incorrect notion that a person might have if he didn't have the blessings over beautiful trees and fields and people, or if he didn't have the blessing over abnormal looking people or animals, meaning there's some sort of a disposition that a person would have and that's something which is not tolerable. So the rabbis came along and made the blessings in order to correct that notion. So the correct approach here would be to look for what the incorrect notion would be, and then we'd have an appreciation for why the blessing comes into the picture. Okay, so Sarah is writing, are these blessings for us to think about the fact that they are from Hashem, so that we don't take things for granted and are repulsed by them? Well, it's true. We should not take things for granted. That seems to fit in more with actual areas of benefit. But how would that apply, Sarah, to seeing abnormal people and then having to make a blessing? What is the disposition that is incorrect? And then what is the correct outlook that we must have? Give me both. Both the incorrect idea that the blessing is coming to correct and what the corrected view must be. Okay, Ira from New York, good to see you. Just do us a favor, type in the words audio okay. Let us know that you're hearing the audio fine. We just started the class. Sarah, elaborate just a bit. What do you mean the beauty? The question is again, what is the wrong disposition that the blessing is coming to correct by abnormal people? And what is our correct disposition? What should we be thinking? All right, anybody else can feel free to answer as well. Gene, we're not saying there's miracles over here. So a miracle's not part of these blessings. And keep in mind the actual text of the blessing. When you see the beautiful people, trees, or fields, you say that there are such as these in your world. And when you see the abnormal people or animals, you say that he distorts the creations in his world. The text of the blessing itself will direct us towards what the concept is. Okay, so Sandy is writing, I think the correct concept is that Hashem blesses every being in the universe. You might want to elaborate more on that. What do you mean he blesses? And how would you know that, too? Sarah in Washington is writing as follows. The correct idea is that we might not focus on the fact that Hashem has made the beauty around us, just that it is nature, forgetting that it is from Hashem. Also incorrect to be repulsed by something misformed and distorted, because these two serve a purpose from Hashem. Okay, true. So we shouldn't be repulsed, but we should recognize that these have a purpose. Okay, I agree with what Sarah's writing. Okay, and good to see you, Michael, in California. Let me just elaborate on what I believe Sarah is getting at. Meaning to say that we have a certain subjective feeling of repulsion when we see something that's abnormal. All right, that is natural. Natural doesn't mean it is permissible or proper according to Torah standards. What we have to do all the time, like the rabbis say, a wicked person is one who tries to conform reality to his own subjective desires, and a tzaddik, a righteous person, is somebody who does the opposite. He conforms his desires to reality. He looks at reality and understands this is how God made the world and how he desires it. Therefore, he changes himself to be in line. So this is a very good example. When you see something that you're repulsed by, specifically animals or people, so then the initial reaction is repulsion. But what's repulsion? Repulsion is when you feel it doesn't fit into your framework of values. Everybody walks around their entire life with their own set of values. Hopefully, as people progress in life, they examine their values and just don't accept them on face value. They look at them and then compare them to the Torah standards, understanding why the Torah standards are correct and why their preconceived values are wrong. And the knowledge that they have about recognizing the truth would all automatically make them abandon their false values and align themselves with the Torah values. So in terms of our own value system, when we see a person or an animal that's repulsive to us because it's deformed, so we have to recognize our repulsion. That's not something we hide from, but we recognize it. But then we have to understand that if this exists, this must be part of God's will. And therefore, we should not have the sense of repulsion, but we should work on it by saying the words that he distorts the creations in his world. Right? He distorts creation. That's his right. So what type of blessing is this? It's a blessing just like when somebody passes away. You hear news of somebody who passes away. So you say, Baruch Dayan HaEmes. Blessed is the righteous judge. Because, again, death is something which probably, compared to all other events, is something which is the most disturbing. Even more than seeing something or someone that is distorted. But in order to recognize that this idea that we have is wrong, we have to say, no, God has the right. He is the proper judge. He is a righteous judge. So when somebody passes away, that is his will. That is his plan. I mean, life itself is his own plan. So he has full rights over life. So similarly, when we see someone or some being, some animal distorted, we recognize God's right. So this blessing is a blessing not to permit us to do something, which is like a blessing over food, but it's a blessing which realigns our sense of judgment in terms of God. We realign ourselves with the correct notion of God being a righteous judge. Okay, so that's the blessing in terms of when we see something distorted. What about the blessings overseeing beautiful people or fields or trees? Why do we say a blessing that there are such as these in your world? All right, and they didn't formulate the blessing as specific as on fruits or vegetables. Even fruits and vegetables, it's not a fruit over an apple or fruit over an orange. It's a I mean, it's not a blessing over an apple or an orange, it's a blessing over fruits in general, that God creates fruits. So here also, it's a blessing over, we say that there are such as these in your world. When we have this, the reaction, so we make a blessing. Okay, Daryl, Rivka, it seems that the goal is to accept all of Hashem's decisions for us. Yes, exactly. And we should understand it. We should understand the truth behind it, because just blind acceptance without really understanding that it makes sense, it's only half of the issue. The real objective is that we're convinced of it. It becomes our own value. Only when something becomes part of our own value system has it really achieved its optimum purpose. Then now we see it as true. But I would say that even when you see beautiful people or beautiful trees and fields, it's the same type of blessing as when you eat a fruit. Because in both cases, what's the common denominator? You tell me, what is the common denominator in both blessings over fruits and blessings over when you see someone or something beautiful? You tell me. So let's just take a minute and think about what the common denominator might be between those two blessings. Sandy is writing that Hashem created them. And Sarah is suggesting recognizing Hashem as the source of that thing. And another writer said it is good. What you're saying is all true, but there's more. You could be more definitive. Well, let me put it this way. What is the affect on the person in these two cases? By foods and by seeing something beautiful. What is the affect on the person? One word. Pleasure, exactly. Daryl has it right in the head. In both cases, you're deriving a pleasure. Now, it doesn't matter that it's pleasure in the physical sense when you have food, or pleasure in the psychological sense when you see something beautiful and it gives you a benefit. The benefit that a person gets in both cases is equal. It's just the mechanism by which you achieve that benefit. The one could be tasting something good, and if you taste something good, you say the blessing before the food. If you ate enough and it gave you a feeling of satiation, then you also say the additional blessing afterwards, which is on the satisfaction. Okay? Now, it doesn't matter whether that pleasure that you get at the outset is going to be physical in nature or whether it will be psychological. So therefore, in both cases, a person benefits equally. And the truth is that you can definitely... you could state that the pleasure is identical, because in both cases it's psychological. Whether you eat food or whether you see something beautiful, the feeling of pleasure, satisfaction, is something which is a psychological reaction. It's a psychological affect on us. And the fact that that's something which God created, that's something which we have to give a blessing for. Okay. Now that we're on blessings, what does this have to do with Hanukkah? All right, nobody asked that yet. So, it was interesting. I was just looking over this morning, And sometimes you can look over an area a number of times, and then one of the most basic questions will just stare you in the face that you never realized before. And what struck me is the blessings that we have when we say, when we light the Hanukkah menorah. One blessing I understand. Yeah, anytime you do an act of a mitzvah, so you define it as a mitzvah by the prayer, whether it's lighting the candles of Shabbos, whether it's picking up the lulav and the esrog, or whether it is reading the Megillah, or whether it's lighting the menorah. So you say the blessing, and you say that you commanded us in your commands, and that you sanctified us with your commands, and you commanded us in XYZ, whatever the mitzvah is. So by Hanukkah we say that we are commanded to light the candles. But then you have the additional prayer, which is specific just to Hanukkah and to Purim, which is the prayer of She'asa Nisim, which we say, blessed are you, our God, blessed are you, God, our God, King of the world, that you did miracles for our forefathers in those days, but in these times. So again, that you did miracles for our forefathers by Yom Mahim in those days, Zman Hazeh, but in this time of the year. Now we have to understand why we're saying this. I ask this primarily because there were many holidays that we have that had miracles in them. Leaving Mitzrayim, or God giving us the Torah and Mount Sinai. Alright, you had events there that were miracles, but we don't say She'asa Nisim by Passover. We don't say She'asa Nisim by Sukkos. We don't say She'asa Nisim by Shavuos. So what is this concept that we're saying She'asa Nisim only by Purim and by Hanukkah? And again, the text of the blessing is that you did miracles for our forefathers in those days, but in these times of the year, in this time of the year. So the question is, what is the purpose of this blessing? Keeping in mind that there were other miracles that God did for our forefathers during Passover, or the miracle par excellence of God giving us a Torah on a fiery mountain, Shavuos. Yet, in those holidays, we don't say the blessing of She'asa Nisim. So the question boils down to why we say it by Hanukkah and Purim, but not by those holidays. Now let me also read you what the Maimonides writes in the end of his Laws of Hanukkah. He says as follows. He says, Mitzvah near Hanukkah, Mitzvah Chaviva Hi Ad Ma'od. The mitzvah, the command of the light of the Hanukkah menorah, is a beloved mitzvah far exceedingly. And the person is needed to be very careful with it in order to proclaim and to make known the miracle. And also to add on praise to Hashem and thanks to Him on the nisims that He did for, on the miracles that He did for us. Even if a person doesn't have what to eat, but he relies on charity, he must ask or sell his shirt and purchase enough oil for the candles, and he must light. All right, then he goes on. If a person only has a pruta achas, like one penny, and he has before him two commands. He has the command, let's say, for example, it's enough money for Kiddush Hayom, right? He needs that money. All he's got is X amount of money. And it could either purchase for him enough money to buy wine for a holiday, but if he spends it now, he won't have it, right? Or he's going to use that money right now to buy the lights of Hanukkah. It's preferable, and he must buy the oil to light the Hanukkah menorah, better than buying wine for Kiddush of a holiday or for Shabbos, right? And he says, even though both of them are from the words of the rabbis, it's better to precede Hanukkah because of the remembrance of the miracle. Okay. Those are the words of Maimonides. And you see, he repeats in there the word miracles many times. All right, and he says the whole reasoning why, even if you only have enough money to buy wine for Shabbos, or to buy your candles for Hanukkah, for example, this Friday night, you would have to buy the candles for Hanukkah and forego buying the wine to be Mekadesh Shabbos, to make Kiddush on wine. What's his reasoning? He says the reasoning is because there is a remembrance of the miracle. Okay. Now, this concept of remembrance of a miracle, why is it that not something which is used by Passover or Shavuos or Sukkos? I mean, those had miracles too. Why are we not referring to miracles in a bracha of Al Hanisim by those three holidays? But we have it only by Purim and by Hanukkah. And you see that the Rambam says that the mitzvah of Hanukkah, the command of Hanukkah, is beloved far exceedingly. So what element in Hanukkah is he referring to? Okay, he can't just say because of Nisan, because you have miracles, because you had miracles by other holidays too. So we have to think a bit here. What exactly is Maimonides referring to? It's not an easy question. But there must be a reason. There must be something which drove Rambam, Maimonides, to make the statement. So think about that for a few minutes now yourself. Okay, if everybody has the question, just type in OK in the window. Let's make sure that everybody has the question clear. Okay, somebody had written the oil was a tangible evidence of the oil. Okay, I'm going to bring up that point. Let's have everybody else think about it for a minute. Think about the blessing too. The blessing says that God did miracles for our forefathers in those days, in these times of the year. Okay, Sarah is saying a good point, as well as one other person who wrote in. Sarah is writing that since Hanukkah and Purim are derabbanan, after the Torah was given, there might be a danger that people wouldn't recognize those miracles being from Hashem. Okay, I'd like to elaborate on that. If you think about the words of the prayer, again, this has struck me today, it was saying that God did miracles for our forefathers in those days, but in this time of the year. And it seemed to be that that might be straddling that there's a continuance of God's relationship. Meaning, it's not just that God did the miracles of Mitzrayim and of Egypt and all the things that took place in the Torah and the Chumash, but even after the conclusion of that, which is undoubtedly God's activity, His interaction with us, there's a continued relationship throughout the generations. And the rabbis chose these two types of events to make holidays around them, where our bodies were being jeopardized, meaning our lives. That was by Purim, when they wanted to wipe us out physically. And also when the Greeks wanted to wipe us out in the time of the First Temple, spiritually, by removing our Judaism. So those are the only two categories into which any type of a risk or a danger is going to be applied to us. So in order to show that relationship is continued throughout all the generations, we say there are miracles that God did to our forefathers in those days, but in these times. And we recite the blessing because we are directly beneficiaries of the goodness that He did. Another idea I thought of also, but you could argue, is what somebody else actually mentioned, is that the actual commands that we're doing today are exact replicas of the commands, excuse me, of the actual miracles. For example, Purim, the salvation of Purim was because the Megillah was something through which the miracle was achieved. It recalls how Ahasuerus, the king, whose first letter was discounted because it was foolish. So when he sent the second letter out to tell everybody to wipe out the Jews, they didn't take him so seriously. Okay, so the letter itself played a role in terms of the Jews' salvation. So we use a letter today in order to celebrate. Same thing by Hanukkah. The very act of lighting the candles today is what the miracle was. So when we talk about Sha'asa Nisim, so perhaps the rabbis only formulated this blessing when we are actually mimicking the very miracle itself. So you don't have it because when we sit down for the Passover Seder, for example, we're not enacting any of the miracles, the 10 plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea. So we're not doing anything to embody those miracles. But here we are. Okay, here we are by Megillah and by Hanukkah, by Purim and by Hanukkah. Now you might even say, well, what about Sukkot? I mean, the Sukkot was something which God protected us with. It's true, but the Sukkah itself was not the miracle. The Sukkah was something which we built. So the Sukkah per se is not actually the miracle. Although Sukkot is a holiday where we commemorate the fact that God protected us in Sukkot, but the protection is what is really what the miracle was. That even being in the desert for that journey from Egypt to Mount Sinai, we were sheltered. So it could be that those distinctions is what caused the rabbis to formulate this specific blessing. And we should say Sha'asa Nisim L'Avoseinu. They did miracles for us, for our forefathers in those days, but in this time. And just to categorize this, so this is something of praise, as opposed to where we had the other blessings we were talking of earlier, of benefits, whether it's psychological benefit, or whether it's a benefit of food, or if we're talking about praising God for His right to be He's a proper judge. So whether it's upon hearing the news of somebody passing away, we say, Dianemus, He's a righteous judge. Or whether we see a distorted creature in the world, that's God's right as well. So He has a right to alter the creation as He sees fit. It's His world, and His distortion is a display of His right to do things as the Creator. So what we do when we say that blessing is we recognize it's a recognition of God's right. So you see, different blessings have different purposes. In terms of removing a false idea, we might think food is something we're entitled to. No, we have to recognize that it comes from God. We might feel that repulsion is the right type of response, and that would display an intolerance for a certain distorted creature. No, but that's not true. You can't be intolerant if God says that this is something which creation demands. However genes work, however the whole procreation process works, or the effects of nature work, on the formative processes of creatures as they're being created in the womb. So that will sometimes produce an abnormal offspring. But that is something which is God's will, and therefore we have to recognize it. So we have to remove from our sense repulsion and align ourselves with the right view, which is God is the creator and he has rights. And by the blessing over here of Alanisim, we also have to recognize that another thing, it's another area we have to recognize, the evidence of God's involvement in the life of the Jews. It wasn't just something at the end of the Torah and then it ended and now God's involvement is not there anymore. No, that's not correct. Like somebody alluded to earlier, that even though the Torah is complete, nonetheless, that does not mean that God's involvement is any less. And these miracles display that. And therefore we have to recognize it with a praise. And I was looking over the laws, and I saw that the Al HaNisim, although a person says it when they light, but if a person is not going to light at all, and nobody's lighting for him in his house, for whatever reason, he could be away, there's nobody around where he is right now, so he can't fulfill the lighting, but if he happens to see somebody else's menorah, he has to say the Al HaNisim, even though he's not saying the Asher Kadoshanu B'Mitzvot Tzivanu L'Hadlik Ner Shel Chanukah, even if he doesn't say the blessing over lighting, since he's not lighting, he would still say the Al HaNisim. And that indicates that there's a real objective over here, that even a person who views it, even though he's not doing the mitzvah, you still see that there is the goal being achieved in the onlooker. So if the onlooker is not, even though he's not fulfilling the command of lighting the Neros, but yet, the fact that there's an affect in him, that he now recalls the miracles, that itself demands that he must say the blessing, that God did the miracles for our forefathers in those days, in this time of the year. Even so, it's not really integrally tied with the command of lighting, because even if a person can't light, but he sees someone else's lit menorah, he still must say the blessing of Al HaNisim. So you see that the real objective is achieved even in a person that's not, even though it's not he's not fulfilling the command, but he still now recognizes, and he is now a recipient of the person who publicized the miracle. So if John lights the menorah, and Sam sees it, even though Sam is not lighting it, yet Sam still has to make the blessing of Al HaNisim. But that is only in the case where he's not lighting himself and nobody else is going to be lighting for him. And he hasn't lit yet. Because then he wouldn't say it if he already said the blessing once already. Okay. Now let's move on. Okay, one more question I'll ask you, and that is a question in the Gemara. The question in the Gemara is that the Gemara makes a statement that the rabbis, you're supposed to say Asher Kadoshanu, that the rabbis commanded us in that God commanded us in doing in lighting the menorah. So the Gemara asks, well, where did God command us? You know, it doesn't talk about Chanukah and the Chumash in the Torah because it came subsequent to the conclusion of the Chumash. But yet we say the words that blessed are you, God, our God, King of the world, who sanctified us with his commands and commanded us in the lighting of the menorah. So where did God command us in the lighting of the menorah? It's a powerful question. Because this is something which the rabbis ordained. So the Gemara gives two possibilities as to where this comes from in the Torah. Because I mean, it has to go back to God's words. If we're saying that God commanded us in lighting a menorah, so then we have to see where does God say it. And God's words are, or we can easily locate them by going through the Chumash and seeing. Because every command has to be in the Chumash. All right, not in writings and not in prophets. It has to be in the Chumash itself, the five books of Moses. So where in, it doesn't say anything about Hanukkah in the five books of Moses, so how can we say the words that God commanded us in Hanukkah? So one rabbi says, and he quotes, it's from the verse that says that you should listen to the rabbis, everything that they tell you, and don't veer from what they say left or right. So since the rabbis have been sanctioned by God in the Torah, that whatever they say we should follow, so if later on, if thousands of years later, the rabbis come along and say, light the menorah, that is in fact God's will, because God says in the Torah, you should follow the rabbis. So if God says to follow the rabbis, and the rabbis tell us that we should light the menorah, so we are in fact following God by following the rabbis. Okay, that's one position. The other position is interesting. It says, no, it's not from there. We don't derive God's words from there. We derive it from when it says the words, ask your father and he will tell you, your elders, and they will teach you, and they will speak to you. So the second view in the Gemara is saying that we understand our command of Hanukkah, and where is the source that God told us to keep Hanukkah? Because it says in the Torah that you should ask your father and he will tell you, or the elders, and they will speak to you. So it's interesting. There it mentions fathers and the elders, as opposed to the rabbis or the judges. The judges would seem to be more in line because they're the ones that institute the Torah system. But according to the second view that says, no, we have another verse in the Torah that we can use to learn out that we have to follow the rabbis. And that is, even if your father tells you something, or if the elders of your city tell you something, that itself is sufficient proof that we should follow Hanukkah. So let me ask you the question as follows. What is the difference between these two rabbis? What are they arguing on in terms of where we derive our rabbinic or our Torah obligations from? One view is that it comes straight from the judges, the ones that set up the Torah system. And another view, which sounds more lenient, is that no, even if your father tells you something and he's telling you over the Torah, or if the elders tell you something, that itself is grounds enough for you to have the obligations to follow the Torah. So what is the difference between the two opinions? Is it the judges on one side, or is it your fathers or the elders? And you see, it's interesting. When it talks about the judges, it says that you should listen to what they tell you. The mishpat, meaning the judgment that they tell you, it actually has the status, the Torah talks about the words of the rabbis having the status of quote-unquote a judgment. That sounds like a real command. That makes sense. But when it talks about your fathers or the elders, it just says what they tell you or what they say to you. It doesn't say that what they're telling you is the mishpat, the judgment of the Torah, or a statute. It doesn't use words like statute or judgment. It just says, ask your father, right, and he'll tell you. So how does something sound so nonchalant and so uninstitutionalized as what your father tells you, as what the elders tell you, how does that carry the weight of a Torah command? Okay, if you got the question, just type an okay in the window. Let me know that you understand the question clearly. Okay, Gene, thank you. Okay. Let's make sure everybody else has the question now. Okay, does everybody have the question? Just type OK in your window, just to make sure the question is clear. Okay, it looks like a lot of you didn't have the question clear, so let me just repeat it. The question is, in the Gemara, where do we derive that God commanded us in the Torah that we should follow the rabbis, or we should follow the command of Hanukkah, which is rabbinic? Is it from a statement that refers to the judges making statutes, or is it from a statement of our fathers or our elders just telling us, repeating over the Torah? The question is, what's the difference between what are the rabbis are arguing on in terms of where we can derive that Hanukkah was really commanded? Are we saying Hanukkah is proven to be a command because God said to the rabbis that whatever statute, I mean, that people have to listen because it's a statute from the rabbis? Or can we even say that we can understand that there's a command of Hanukkah and that it has to be followed, and that was actually commanded by God because of another statement of God in the Torah, and that is that you should listen to what your fathers or your elders tell you? Okay, so let me suggest the following. I'd like to suggest that perhaps the argument is what actually carries weight as an obligation on us. Is it only what the rabbis tell us and has the status of a statute? So that's what the first rabbi is saying. He's saying in the Gemara that we only know that we have to follow what the rabbis tell us as something which is mandated by God, because God wrote in the Torah, you should listen to the statutes that the rabbis tell you. And you shouldn't veer from what they say left or right. But the other rabbi in the Gemara is saying, no, we don't even have to go that far. Even something which your father or your elders tell you over as Torah, that itself has an obligation upon you. And the proof really is that there's a statement of the rabbis that a custom carries the weight of Torah. Even a custom, not a scriptural law, not even a rabbinic law, but even a custom, which is the lowest of all three, it itself is something which we have to follow like Torah. Minhag, Torah hi. A minhag is Torah. So if that's true, certainly if your fathers or elders teach us something, that's something which carries the weight of obligation. Obligation comes upon us even if we're told something through just tradition of our fathers or our elders passing down something to us. We are not free from following it because we didn't hear it from the mouth of the rabbis. So I think that's a dispute in the Gemara. Just type in OK if you see that distinction. Okay, Sarah? Jean, thank you. So, what we'll do is we'll wrap it up in terms of topics for Hanukkah, and then we'll just sit for the next few minutes. If there's any other questions on the topic or off the topic, we'll just do a little Q&A like we did last week. So if you have questions, we'll take that up now. Okay, so it looks like there's no questions for this afternoon, so we're going to then end the session now. You look at the schedule, you'll see when the next class is going to be, and we'll meet back at that time. Again, it'll be 1:30 New York time when we meet in this forum. And until then, I wish everybody a good Hanukkah. Have a good week, and we'll speak to you all soon. Okay, take care.